Now let's see.
The unique feature, I say, of the first 50 years of this country's political existence, we said, has been its complete transformation from a people into an organized public. It is perhaps interesting for you to note that the very word organization is not older than 1780 and is therefore absolutely contemporary with America's independent life. To organize means to make an organism. And of course, if you make organisms, they are artificial indeed. And therefore, they have all the signs of the what you find in our friend James Fenimore Cooper's American Democrat, this transformation of people into a public. Everybody a mind in his own right, but nothing but a mind, and therefore terribly fickle. On the other hand, if you act as a mind, as an individual, as it is called very often, as an independent, then you are, of course, able to join any number of causes. And as you know, in this country there are innumerable causes. I put them, the main ones of the first half of the 19th century, here once more, because I said already, and this we will have to follow up today, for feminism, the most important of all these movements, that not one of them has achieved its true goal. Pacifism has led to World War II. Prohibition has led to the repeal and to two orgies of drinking. There's more drinking, not less drinking now than before prohibition in this country. Abolition has, one cannot say that abolition has saved the South, as Little Rock bears out. And vegetarianism, I told you again, is a mental attitude which does not solve our problem of artificial food. Since, however, the question of women's rights in this country is, of course, the determinant for the character of America, for its membership in a mankind which produces different types of humanity, it is today shall be my endeavor to go a little more carefully at work in the movement of feminism. I first of all would like to tell you that I shall ask you in the finals to know something of one of the heroes of these five movements, and you may take your pick. I shall ask a question about the life, biography, contribution, character of one of the four following women, leading women in this country. The oldest one is Lucretia Mott, M-O-T-T. The next one is Lucy Blackwell Stone. The third is Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And the youngest one is Susan B. Anthony. Now I take it that all the ladies, of course, know the lives of these ladies, women, very well, but I can't expect it from the boys. So, just the same, even the male in this country now is, of course, has to look at the great models in womanhood in this country. Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, and Lucy Blackwood Stone. The women's movement in this country is already foreshadowed in the new relation of the men in this country to their country. And I may not have convinced you, but I have tried to suggest that men's relation to this country is the opposite from Europe because the country is the daughter and not the motherland. It is not a fatherland either, but it's a country to be endowed. My friend Paige Smith showed me the other day the volume of endowed foundations in this country. There are 8,000 of them for any purpose in the world. That is, men have made wills in which they have endowed this country for any problem to be solved. You take all this for granted, but it isn't. It's a unique situation that people have set aside for the future, not just nonsensical wills as old ladies who give it for so that cats may not have to be executed, but these 8,000 foundations are serious business. You and I, we couldn't live in America without it. The 8,000 represent the only, now mark you well, I'm saying this with all consideration, and I know what I'm saying, the only place for the arts and sciences in which they are treated as they should be treated, as the treasure around beauty, the beauty of the young women who need the arts and to be decorated. And you always think of the arts in the abstract as something highfalutin, but any woman has to be adorned. And all the art begins simply with the music of the wedding march and with the flowers for the corset, and it begins with the simplest adornment of beauty. And therefore, these foundations make room for something for which the American businessman in the American city or the American village just have no place. Beauty, leisure, the arts, that which is useless and which boasts of being useless. If you are asked what's the use of the arts, you can only give back the famous answer which was given here by a desperado when he was asked such a silly question. What is the use of a newborn child? There is no use of a newborn child. Created things are in themselves meaningful. Never ask what's the use of science or what's the use of the arts. If you try to answer, you already have given the devil the little finger. And this is now going on. People try to prove that they are useful. They aren't useful. Because they are the ends. Useful can only be means. If you are useful, you are instrumental. And then you are pragmatic, and then you live for somebody else. Not one of you is in his highest existence justified by because he's an instrument for something useful. I think I told you the story of my experience in education, that a citizen was a man who was profitably employed. Didn't I tell the story? No. A citizen is a man, you see, who can go beyond himself because he can found a community when there is none. That's citizenship. That is, you can be an individual and you can be one degree higher. You can do more than just be yourself, you see. You can dismiss from your loins a new group. That's the highest what a citizen can do, you see, found a city. So will you kindly note that in the problem of American womanhood, to this day, there stands before you your own decision to avoid all pragmatic and utilitarian philosophies by which people try to express the idiotic idea that we belong to the realm of means, that we are useful. I hope that you are absolutely useless, because that's the only way for going to heaven. All people who are only useful go to heaven. And this has to be said because most people I meet are overworked because they have a terrible fear that they aren't useful. Now, if the person sleeps well and plays well and laughs well and jokes well, that he's obviously on the way to paradise. But if he only is tearing his head, you see that he has or she has so many things to do, then it's high time that she takes a rest and isn't cluttered up so totally. And doesn't think that her justification is by works, but her justification is by faith. And nobody, not one of us, deserves to live if you reckon what we can achieve. I mean, our achievements are all minus. Now, these women have impressed the American men with this doctrine, but now the women, strangely enough, are run away from their own perfection and want to be useful, charitable, organized, you see, etc., etc. Every one of them goes into a factory or into a business, leaves their children at home and want to be useful. That's a very strange outcome of a movement that sprang from the following male experience. In a strange way, there is a tradition in this country for this, which of course is hidden, which I like to bring to your attention. As you know, there is quite a Dutch streak in this country. The Dutch, in their fight against Spain, set a great example of independence in the time of Cromwell. They already were, you see, independent from the big old monarchies. They not only had New Amsterdam, which is today New York, but they also had at home a constitution in which the Lord Protector, the Stadtholder, as he was called, the Prince of Orange, and the freedom of the cities were in a very similar way connected as between General Washington and the 13 colonies. And the 13 colonies couldn't help, when they got independence, you see, to think in similar terms, that they now needed a chief executive, you see, but that he shouldn't own them in any way. And you know there was a dispute. Mrs. Washington would have liked to become queen in America, but it couldn't be done. The Americans wanted nothing of it, you see. And I told you that Washington's birthday couldn't be celebrated because it was too much like royalty. On the other hand, everybody in America quoted the general as the important decider, and I gave you an example of this in my last time's quotation, that Mr. John Jay couldn't say anything more important to the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Madrid, in Spain, but that the general wanted the Mississippi Valley, you see, and the general that was Washington. So he had a place all by himself, like the Prince of Orange. Now, John Adams, while the war was raging, had to live in Holland and had to negotiate loans because the people here were on a spending spree and had a very hard time to get the money for their guns and ammunition. And he copied for the benefit of the people at home, for the Continental Congress, a description of the what he calls the stadtholdership, that is, the place the Prince of Orange held in this in the 12 republics of Holland. And you always have to think 13 colonies and 12 republics at that time seemed very similar indeed. Also in numbers, the Dutch Holland was as peopled as the United States, 2.5 to 3 million people, you see, there and here. And there were these old relations that, as you know, the Pilgrim Fathers had first gone to Holland and lived in Leiden because of the religious tolerance that existed there. So he says, I'm sending you an account of the Dutch Constitution. It is full of instruction for the United States of America, and it will serve to explain many political phenomena. Now, what does he say? I can't read you the whole paper, but what I have to tell you is the following. Offers the most tempting for the princes of Orange and for their houses have been made to the stadtholders, provided they would depart ever so little from the engagements which they had taken with their country. But they have rejected them all with disdain, and would not have other friends nor other enemies than those of the Republic. Think of Benedict Arnold. That's just exactly the contemporary, you see. Arnold who did not act like this, you see. that they have rejected them all with disdain and would not have other friends nor other enemies than those of the Republic. And now, will you kindly copy the following sentence into your notes? As she was in some sort their daughter, they could not but have a lively affection for her. As she was in some sort their daughter, they could not but have a lively affection for her to such a degree as to be at all times ready to sacrifice their lives and all things to her defense. Now that is an unheard of language which you only find in the Old Testament, in the Song of Songs perhaps, that men are willing to sacrifice their lives not for their mother tongue or their patriotism, but because they love their country as their daughter. As she was in some sort their daughter, they could not but have a lively affection for her to such a degree as to be at all times ready to sacrifice their lives and all things to her defense. This is written on October 11th, 1780. At such an early date, you see, the Americans tried to find a special relation to their country different from the kingdoms of Europe, worthy of free men and yet with the full responsibility of sacrifice and of belonging. Nothing of utilitarianism there, nothing of individualism, but an insoluble identification as between father and daughter. And I think that this passage deserves to be written as the motto over the problems which are besetting this country to this day. The place of the woman, but of the feminine qualities of the human soul, which are of course just as much in every man as they are in every woman. You and I, we are human only if I contain as many feminine elements as you are able to contain masculine elements. And it is, what I want to bring out is that the daughter, for the first time in the history of mankind, has become, of sexual political history, has become a type, an attitude of great worldwide importance. Since it is never mentioned in your discussions of individualism and women's rights, it is high time for you that you say goodbye to momitis and motherhood and so on, and think in these terms of your relations in this country. Because obviously, if this has been stressed or perhaps overstressed, you will also find only then access to the other attitudes, sister, bride, and related types. I do not say that women can only live as daughters, but since they are treated here as the treasure to be endowed, to be showered with, the word shower is a good expression, as we know, in the engagement party just before the wedding, she is the center of attention. Or anything that is done too much to her in this country or too little to her, both will have to be cured by her consideration from her central and strangely unique position. The women in this country came to be part and parcel of the political scene because they were needed for the petitions for all the other great causes. Women's rights have come into the forefront here not so much because they first asked for their own rights, but for 50 years they signed petitions for the slaves, they signed temperances, they joined temperance societies, they joined prohibition societies. They were, of course, the great supporter of Channing, the Unitarian minister, in his peace drive. Therefore, women joined the fray or the political battle by indirection, by making these causes, you see, first their own causes. Without the women, the abolition movement could never have made any headway, Charles Sumner, the senator from Massachusetts, who was the leading abolitionist in the North with William Lloyd Garrison, wrote to his friend Susan Anthony, send petitions with your signatures. That's all I have to go by in the Senate, you see, in the 50s of the 19th century. So you see that the woman came into the political scene not as a voter, which she had no vote, and not as a technologically emancipated woman who had no work to do in the kitchen, but as something third, as a chorus in the Greek tragedy, as a petitioner for other people's rights, invoking mercy for the slaves, invoking men's interest for peace. And it is important that you see that there is, besides your strange idiosyncrasy only to see individuals in the world, I know where I see individuals, I have never seen an individual so far, except people who commit suicide. We all live, of course, by being called into life, by other people's needs. We are kept going because other people ask something from us. And the right of petition was for these women the discovery that they already were asked to do something in the community. They couldn't be denied, you see, the right of petition, although they did not vote. And I want you to, I cannot go into all the wonderful details of this right of petition story, but it's a great story. The most eloquent handler, manipulator of petitions in the United States has been John Quincy Adams, who from 1831 to 1848 indefatigably forced the House of Representatives in Washington to listen to the petitions which he laid before them. Several times he was to be ejected for this from the House because people, the South just was infuriated with his petitions signed by Negroes, by slaves, and by women. So one day he would defend the right of women to petition, the other day the right of Negroes. I have here one very beautiful thing which is at the bottom of the power of this country to revamp its political structure by the right of petition. I have another quotation from him here. Well, there's a very eloquent plea made by him in the year 1837 in the House of Representatives that, and he simply asks the eloquent question when the people shout, the gentleman from the South, women, Negroes, that's a contempt of the House that you handle such stuff here. He says, what? Men should not have the right to implore his neighbor for an act of mercy. I think that's the most beautiful sentence ever spoken in a political group. And I can assure you that all the visitors from Europe to whom I read this sentence begin to understand the United States. It is this one sentence that has never been denied in this country to this day, and which doesn't exist in France. It doesn't exist in Germany. It doesn't even exist in England. You could not say in a political body with any understanding that anybody can implore his neighbor for an act of mercy and make this the principle of our mutual behavior. And you don't know yourself. You are all poisoned with a European political, scientific, and philosophical dogmas about right, reason. And this is not America. Pardon me, but I'm a better American than many of you. Because this one sentence has been inherited from the 18th century. It's a membership in the churches and the synagogues of this country. That you can appeal publicly to the fact that anybody has the right of petition, you see, to ask for an act of mercy from his neighbor. And people will be with. And they will bow to it. 40 years ago, a friend of mine, she's now an old lady and grandmother, a great-grandmother, as a matter of fact, was a young architect here in this country at MIT. in Massachusetts. And she heard of the massacres of the Armenians in Asia Minor by the Turks during World War I. And she was upset, and she wanted to rescue the remaining Armenians and bring them to this country, as it later had really been done. Many Armenians are here because of this act of mercy of this young woman. But how was it brought about? She went to the State Department in Washington and went to the allegedly competent man in the passport division, and she said, "You have to let these people in. I petitioned for them." These men said, "Do you have any credentials?" "Oh no, I don't know who they are. I only know they are in this plight. But I intervene for them. You have to bring them over." Well, he laughed and said, "Why, the law says that these people have to apply to the next American consul, and there they can, of course, perhaps get a visa, and then they may come over." Well, he said, "That won't work. You have to give me a blanco, and I have one friend in Asia Minor, and then he'll do what he can to put these people on ships." "It's impossible. I have absolutely no instructions. I can't do this." "Well," she said, "you will have to." He said, "Well, what are you going to do?" "Well, I'm going to sit here." "Well, when I leave the room, I will have to lock you up or not. That doesn't make any difference," she said, "I still." But when, by a large lady, he said, young Charlotte was her name, "What are you thinking that I can do? This is outside my power." "Oh," she said, "that's very simple. You are going to let these Armenians in." "But why?" he said, "why?" "Well," she said, "that's very simple. You wish to go to heaven, and of course you have to knock at the door, and then Peter will be there, and he'll say, 'Who are you?' And he will say, 'Let me in. I'm a decent fellow in the civil service of the United States.'" And then she said, "But I'll be there. And I'll tell Peter, don't let him in. He didn't let the Armenians in." Now, pardon me, only to show you the abyss that separates you from the year of the Lord 1916. They came. He did let them in. This threat worked. Inheritance. It wouldn't today. You are all absolutely ruined by the FBI and the McCarthy setup, etc. I asked my friends in class in the college several times, different classes in the last year, if they would protect a guest at their house against the police. If at midnight there would be a knock at the door, would they still, as a southern man who gives hospitality to a guest, would they still think that the guest was under their custody and that they had to identify themselves with this guest? Did they still know what hospitality meant in these modern matchboxes in which we live? It is very hard to think. There is not even a guest room by these modern, allowed for by the modern architect. The grandmother cannot live there, the stepmother, the mother-in-law cannot live there, let alone a guest. And therefore, people have lost the feeling, just this feeling, that here is a man imploring their mercy. That's what a guest is. The weaker, you see, can demand hospitality just as a woman, because the weaker makes a man human. Anybody who can extend, you see, help to a weaker person is a human being. Your behavior towards a baby shows that, you see, that you become a human by not trampling on the baby, but protecting him, although the baby cannot secure this protection in its or his own mind. So the weaker, and Americans are quite strong, and so they have always helped the weaker. My students, I don't know what their answer would be, but my students assured me after deliberations of several weeks that they would proceed in the following manner. If the sheriff came and would ask the guest for a simple felony or crime, you see, a real crime, they would protect him, because I'll tell you later why. that if the FBI came for high treason and political independent thought, they would give him up. Now, obviously, the answer should be the other way around. Obviously, the man should be protected for his political views, you see, and he should be extradited if he was just, an arsonist or terrorist. But what's the reason? The sheriff tradition, which you see in the Wild West, Wild Western film, is of the 18th century. And therefore, people understand that sheriffs can be, are equal, so to speak. You see, you elect the sheriff, and therefore you can cheat him. It can go against them. But the FBI, that's a big mystery in the sky, and therefore you cannot go against it. That's under some at its best, or at its worst. Now, you live in two worlds at this moment, most of you, because you still boast of your individual reason and so on, but when it comes to the higher powers of corporations and government, you are servile. The servile state is with us. I have never seen so much servility as I have seen in in the younger generation. It's just appalling. In practice, everybody has this completely split personality. He reasons out everything for himself. He says he can commit suicide. I have even people who will argue that you have to help a man to commit suicide. Decent women tell me that they would help any man who is a candidate for suicide to carry out this wonderful idea. So the deprivation, the disintegration is total. That's the libertinism. But on the other hand, there is no liberty in the political realm. I mean, your own guest is given up by you at heart to the FBI. So there is no hospitality left. So wildest savage wouldn't do such a, wouldn't perpetrate such a crime, such an individualization, such a lack of cohesion between two human beings. As I have seen people commit, a colleague one day when Hitler invaded France came to me with a staple of books and said to me, would I accept these books from him as a present? I thought it was a nice idea. Then I looked at it, it was a communist manifest, and it was Lenin and Trotsky, and all those writings, and he said, what do you mean? And he said, you know, when Hitler now comes to America, you are lost anyway. But I don't like these books to be found on me. That's a similar idea. To run and to abandon your next of kin, he was my next colleague in the department, you see, show him to the dogs and get away with it. So this is quite serious. We have in the last 40 years, I have to remind you, lost all the concatenation of affection and fear and love and faith and hope, which was carried through the 19th century as a natural from the Indians. And you are at this moment, therefore, in a very difficult position to recognize what is America. What they say to you since 1910 in America is a council of despair. It is neither 19th century nor 18th century. It is just nihilism, suicide. My students argued the case that after all, Jesus had committed suicide. I told you this here today. And Hitler had sacrificed himself for his nation. There was a good American boy who had the two theses, that Hitler had sacrificed himself not too well for his people, and that Jesus had committed suicide. Now, we live, therefore, in a world in which the old petition for mercy and mutual help, you see, is no longer understood. People will turn away from you. I've seen people in New York, you see, being run over, and three-quarters of the people rushing on and trying not to see what was happening in order not to be stopped and not having to help. So beware. I'm not so sure that you have any right to link up with the 19th and 18th century Americanism. At this moment, there is this half and half. There is still this underground tradition in many families alive. But what I see on the official campuses and the official magazines and so, that is just nothing. This is just absolute decadent and has no relation to the great story of America And that happens at the end of every century. That there is one generation, you call it the lost generation or the angry generation. You can also call it the decadent generation, the degenerates, the scoundrels, however you call it. The silly generation is perhaps the best expression. And this silly generation, in the ears of these men, they do no longer ring the fundamental sentences of America's creed, that women are the daughter, representative of the daughterland of the future of this country, and that men endow them, and that every man is every man's brother or sister, so that everybody can implore everybody's help, you see, and hasn't to reason out whether he's introduced to him or not. The women, after they had been used or served as the signers of these petitions, very naturally then thought of their own position in society. But I'm so anxious to make you see that if you have the famous individual in America with his own mind as the captain of his soul, all these wonderful experiences, there always has been a class of people in the first half of the 19th century, the women, who were half articulate. They were not voters, but they were in a position to make, to speak, to make themselves very, very articulate indeed. And this is overlooked. If I read the books, the textbooks, for example, on the American story, one half is always left out. I read the story, for example, of the slaves, of the abolition. And I have now two, three textbooks that are used in American colleges, one over with the ground of these books for the purpose of. They nowhere mention that three quarters of these Negroes have been begotten by white men, by white fathers. And therefore the whole real story of American Negro, you see, is not mentioned, that they have been loved. In a, you may say, not much love, but some affection was there from white men. The problem of the South is so desperate because they are all cousins. They are all legitimate cousins, illegitimate cousins. And that's, of course, much worse. The enmity between people in a family who don't like each other are always much more serious than the relations between people who don't know of each other, you see. It is very easy to love the Eskimo, but it is very much more difficult to love your daughter-in-law. And in this country, the venom, the violence of the Negro question, the Ku Klux Klan, of course, comes from the fact that all the parents, fathers of the people who are now the Ku Klux Klan have gone to bed with the daughters of the black race, and now they say they have to take an oath in the front of their women, never again, never shall our daughters, you see, do this with a black man. So it is a very strange relation of a semi-personal character. The slave before the last industrial decade of the cotton kingdom, down to 1840, you may say, the slave was a semi-person. That is, he had made himself felt. He did speak. He did sing. He did sit in the same service, in the same worship with the family now. Now, you cannot worship God together without becoming kin, a kin. It's just a cartoon. All the segregation stuff doesn't exist because the people had went to church together and cared for each other, as they still are very glad in the South that the Negro woman is asked to bring up the children, and she does it very well, probably much better than a white woman. All these are pre-personal forms of political existence. Will you kindly note that I'm trying to convince you of the fact that no society ever has consisted of individuals. It cannot. There is always, besides the individuals, there are beings like the children, and till 1850 like the women and the Negroes. We see that later this takes a different form after 1850, who are very important members of the ecclesiastical kingdom of our souls. their mind doesn't, you see, isn't considered. They don't write philosophies, they don't vote, they don't make their will felt in legislation, and therefore, the attributes which you give so freely to every human being, that he is a man under his own will, under his own steam, with his own mind, have never been applied to these people. And today, one isn't allowed to mention this even, because today the women and the Negro have acquired personality, no doubt about that. But they hadn't in 1850s. They made themselves felt, they petitioned, they spoke, they prayed, they sang. All the people's attributes were with them. They were a member of the people, but they were not members of the public. They belonged to the private life of the community. Can't you see this? And if you split the existence of a people into private forms of life and public forms of life, then you are apt to overlook, to only to think that everybody must become join the public, and you overlook that perhaps some part of the population are better off if there are no demands made on them for becoming public figures. That they would be much happier if they would be allowed to remain members of the people but not have to become members of the public. This is, after all, very serious. The first woman who showed that she wanted to serve and leave the people and the family and become a person in the public life, I would like to mention, for a very simple act. Her name is Lucy Blackwell Stone. She lived from 1818 to 1893, and she did that which is now quite common in America, but which was unheard of in her days. When she got married, I think it was in 1848, again one of these, at the moment of decision in this country, at the great turning point, she declined to accept the name of her husband, and she went on to call herself Lucy Stone. Just as Miss Perkins remained a Secretary of Labor, Miss Perkins, and hardly does anybody know in this home what her real name is. Miss Perkins, the Secretary of Labor in the Roosevelt administration. Well, of course you say her real name is Miss Perkins. But I think that our future is more real than our past, and if you marry, it would be a curse if you wouldn't accept your new name, in my estimation. Because that means that you can really are free to change. And if you are cursed with your accidental first beginner's name, that means that you can never be transformed, never be reborn, never be regenerated, never become an original person. That you are just a dependence, you see, on the clan who gave you the name. But today, with your naturalism, you think that it is exceedingly nice for a woman to have the right to keep her maiden name when she gets married. Well, the only result is that she can't marry. I mean, she can go to bed with a man, but she said cannot become his mate, because that makes him over, and he only is made over because he can quote her as his wife. I'm not speaking of her so much as of him, you see. A man who cannot point out that his wife, you see, agrees with him, can never be in the majority, because a man with his wife together isn't the majority. As far to other, because he has convinced one person that he is right, and more doesn't. Well, isn't that true? The immense power that accrues to an individual who can point out that his wife is ready to go to Australia with him or to the end of the world, that's much more than to say of yourself that you are off. That is nothing. The bachelor, I mean, erratic, proves nothing. He goes just on to adventures. But when his wife is ready to leave the country with him, the cause must be a really good cause. She must believe in it. When Mr. Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic, I had on the solo flight, I think it was 1928, he wrote a book. Who knows how the book was called?
We.
Yes, because you cannot go alone. He had to call it We, because he had no wife then with him, but it was his plane, which represented all the work and genius of American workmanship. Herbert Hoover, the president at that time, made a very wonderful speech on the occasion. He welcomed him home and said, in the We, Mr. Lindbergh had taken to heart all the workmanship of America, you see, everything that had supported him in flying this Eagle of St. Louis, or what was it?
Spirit
of St. Louis. We, gentlemen, is a great creation in middle life. And people who, since Lucy Stone, declined this honor to become a we can really say that individualism in this country has triumphed. In the year 1850, then, it is true to say that with the abolitionism already lurking big, and with the prohibition, men's will and men's mind had cut up the country into as many individuals as there were heads, allegedly. Of course, the children never come into this, but as you know, since 1850, even children today are treated as though they were individuals, to their great misery and calamity. I told you the story of the little child. My own son had to treat him as a psychiatrist, and parents brought a very gifted child to him, whom they had ruined. The child was musical. So the parents had, in their vanity, insisted that the child at the ripe age of one already should be learn to distinguish the composer and composers, and know what was by Schubert and what was by Beethoven. Well, this child was destroyed in this process, and when he came to my son to be treated, he was just a vegetable. If you treat a child as an individual, you see, at a time when it has no business to be treated as an individual, you destroy the child. I'm very serious, gentlemen. Every human being is born as a genius, but only if you leave him without responsibility and without choices. Because you have to command. He has to obey. A child that hasn't obeyed cannot keep his genius. You do not allow children to obey, so they all go to sleep. They have to make too many choices to earn. I've seen children sitting in a restaurant of the ripe age of 3, and they had to order their menu themselves. That kills the child. That kills the child. Because the child must trustfully be in this frame of reference of other people's directions, and then it can learn, for it's unmemorized. It can learn them or every other language, here it is, but it must be left without decision. It must be told. So instead that the children should learn something in your schools today, and know Latin at 10 and Greek at 12 and French at 14, they know nothing, and at 20 then they try to learn Spanish so that they can make money in South America. It's very tragic. This country has, by carrying over the idea of the individual where that doesn't belong, has made people, has destroyed. I got a commission when I lived in Germany. A committee visited me from America saying, we are destroying all genius. We still understand that in Central Europe you have found ways and means of protecting genius. Wouldn't you kindly tell us what to do? That serious was the situation 30 years ago in the eyes of serious American educators. There are no better people here. But you don't allow them to be people. As we say, they are the best people in the world. Makes them into a public. They're all fools. A child that cannot obey in the first 7 years of the world can never take command, can never lead. And all these leadership classes which you now have are just ridiculous, because how can you lead when you haven't learned to be led? You have now, I'm told, in these classes here everywhere, leadership classes, probably leading to the icebox. leadership what for? Leadership, don't use this wonderful term for the silly things it is used now today for leadership. Leadership, I accept Stonewall Jackson as a leader, or Sam Houston, but I don't accept 12-year-old boys as leaders. To what? For what? For eating cheese sandwiches. What do they lead into? It is all corrupt. Every great word in this moment in this country is abused for ridiculous things, for play-like things. A child should never be heard here of leadership in play-like fashion. That's a coach, and that's a quarterback, and that's all right for this, you see. But it isn't the leader. That's reserved for a serious business when your life is at stake. Well, the women, of course, have paid the penalty of all this. They did get the vote. But nothing has been changed by getting the vote. Absolutely nothing. Now, before the women did get the vote, just to give you an example, I told you that pacifism has not reached its goal. The way war will disappear is by the power of the weapons. The old famous Nobel, whose Nobel Prizes you all know, was much more intelligent than just to give money to inventors. That is the Swedish inventor of dynamite. He was a very great man, and he saw clearly and argued with the pacifists of the end of the 19th century already that war would be abolished because he knew that if men could make the weapons so atrocious, you see, that they would recoil on the victor, and as we have it today, you see. So war, as Alcoholic Anonymous, is necessary to fight the alcoholic, you see, depraved. That is the formation of a group. So it is with the weapons of mankind, so it is with the foodstuff of mankind, so it is the Negro question in the South, that you cannot legislate any of these things by will, by an idea of your mind. Idealism, gentlemen, in dealing with the people's problem is out of the question. Your ideal will doesn't happen. It doesn't work. And the reason, of course, is because we are not fully in our own, represented by our own mind. The alcoholic, I have here a friend in the Palisades. He came out from our little village to live here. He had been an alcoholic, and now he devotes himself to saving other people by this Alcoholic Anonymous business, where he invests his whole life in this. That's more than his wife. He doesn't give a signal to a petition. But he is there day and night, like a doctor, like a nurse. At this moment, you can change the world. You cannot solve the women's problem by writing a signature that you want to get the vote. And then by voting. The mind is timeless, I told you. And the mind has no sense of timing. It has no perseverance. It has no patience. And your heart can persevere against all the moods of your conscious life. Then you will achieve something. Anything that is just the subject of our will, our aim, our own goals, our own purposes, is below our human dignity. Not our will must be done. It must be always done a higher will. And this higher will always demands the investment of our whole person, and not just the investment of a signature or vote or bill in Congress or letter to your Congress. That just isn't enough to change the world. Well, I'm very disappointed. My time is up here.